This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio EcoShock. I'm your persistent collector of voices, Alex Smith. 10 years ago, when I began broadcasting this program, my goal and my passion was to save humanity and the creatures from dangerous climate change. I would do it by presenting proven facts, as published by science, with illumination from authors and the example of brave activists. All that failed. We are still in a car hurtling towards the cliff of a terrible shift in climate. We are still debating whether to take our foot off the accelerator, much less hit the brakes. That is because we are addicted not just to fossil fuels, but to energy slaves. All of us. Me too. The most experienced scientists, even the heads of most governments, know we are headed into dangerous climate disruption. I wondered what the only world body formed to address this, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, would do. It turns out that body just held an introductory meeting in Geneva this past August. It's a scoping meeting, laying out the groundwork for a report due out in 2018. The subject? The grave risks of a world 1.5 degrees hotter than the days before we began this mass industrial experiment. As you'll hear, we have already breached that danger line of 1.5, at least for part of 2016. This week, we'll hear from two of the top-level scientists advising governments via the IPCC. These are the big-picture experts who assess extreme weather events. And as we'll talk about next week, there are plenty of extreme events happening around the world. What to tell the children? Later in this program, we'll also spend a few minutes eavesdropping on what Australian desert birds tell their embryos inside the egg. That prepares them for hotter times. But first this. From pole to pole, science is reporting more climate change faster than expected. How can this be communicated to governments and to the people so we have a hope to avert the most dangerous climate shift? We've reached two experts at the top of that process. Later we'll talk with Catherine Mack. She's just attended the latest Geneva meeting on a climate 1.5 degrees centigrade hotter than the pre-industrial era and beyond. But first, let's talk with Dr. Chris Field. Since the mid-1980s, he's founded and led the Stanford University-based Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology. Dr. Field is internationally recognized for his role as co-chair of Working Group 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Among other things, that group led to the IPCC 2012 Special Report on Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation. In the space where scientists advise governments, Chris Field is an expert's expert. Dr. Field, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
As I watch the news, Chris, and new climate science, it's my impression climate change is arriving harder and sooner than scientists expected. How do earlier forecasts by the IPCC fit with what is happening now?
I think there's strong evidence that we are seeing impacts of climate changes that have already occurred. Some of these are occurring sooner than projections, but the pattern we're seeing is also very consistent with a climate that's being pushed consistently by human emissions of heat-trapping gases. The new thing that's really shaped our understanding in the last few years is understanding the way that climate change plays out in terms of altering the profile of risk. What we're seeing is the changes that have already occurred alter the odds of impacts that really influence people, ecosystems, and economies. It's not that every person in every location is impacted, but there's a greater probability that things go wrong, that there's flooding, fire, heat waves, and that those impacts are adding up around the world.
So tell us a little bit about the IPCC report on the risks of extreme events and what we see now.
Back in 2008, several countries asked the IPCC to take a careful look at the relationship between climate change and risk of extreme events. Extremes are kind of a sharp end of the climate stick. It's where things really break and where harms really occur. And as I indicated, what we're seeing is a clear pattern that climate changes that have already occurred have altered the risks of many kinds of extremes. Extremes of high temperature, extremes associated with heavy precipitation, and extremes that depend on high sea level, where storm surge or a spring tide is on top of a high sea level. This pattern of changes have already occurred has resulted in altered odds of impacts around the world. We don't know that every extreme has been associated with climate change, but we're seeing a clear pattern of more and more events that are consistent with climate change. And we've also seen the emergence of a really dramatically new kind of science where we can, for individual events, attribute the change in odds of that event occurring to the climate changes that have already occurred. And we've seen that many events, especially high temperature events over the last few decades, are really clearly associated with climate changes that have already occurred.
I was pretty impressed with the rainfall that they got in Louisiana, 4 months of rain overnight. And so what you're saying, that the chances of that being, say, not a 1 in 1,000-year event, but maybe it'll happen more often. Is that what we're saying?
That's exactly right. The specific change in the probability of a heavy rainfall event like the one we saw in Louisiana has not been analyzed in detail. But in general, we know that a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. And around the world, we've seen a larger and larger proportion of the rainfall falling in the heaviest events. So these kinds of very heavy storms that aren't necessarily associated with a greater annual rainfall, but with more of the rainfall falling in a concentrated period, are getting to be increasingly common, and they're exactly what we expect in a warmer atmosphere.
You know, almost 10 years ago, I talked with Dr. Joe Rome, and he's a former advisor in the Clinton administration and later a famous climate journalist at his blog, Climate Progress. And Joe said we still had time for action because the atmosphere was only warming by about 0.1 degree per decade. Now, almost 10 years later, it looks like we've gone up 0.1 degree just this year alone in 2016. Maybe it'll go down a bit next year. Maybe it was El Nino. But have we already touched on the 1.5 degree danger zone laid out in the Paris Agreement?
If you look back at the formulation of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, what it says is that the goal of the convention is to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. I think the most recent IPCC reports have clearly shown that we're seeing dangerous anthropogenic interference, seeing real impacts on real people. 1.5 is an important point in the trajectory because it really represents an amount of climate change where we can identify a whole range of impacts that become increasingly serious. On the other hand, we also know that we're seeing impacts now. The way I think about it is that the risks increase rapidly with the amount of warming, and 1.5 represents some very clear increments to the level of danger. 2 represents additional increments. 2.1 represents increments beyond that, and there are profound advantages to limiting the amount of warming as much as we possibly can. In 2016, for the first 3 months, the global average temperature was already 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial for the first 3 months of any year. So we're already flirting with that level. It may be that the temperature cools back as a result of internal variability, but we're definitely very close to that 1.5 number. It's also important to remember that 1.5 isn't any kind of a magical guardrail or threshold. We're already seeing danger. We need to be investing in coping as effectively as possible with the risks that we already face. And the more warming we see, the more we're going to have to invest in dealing appropriately with climate change risks.
You know, that's something that really worries me, that we might have a couple of colder winters in the Northern Hemisphere so the public starts to doubt global warming and all deniers say it's not happening. And, you know, Dr. Hansen is among a group of scientists who say this could happen, at least in the UK and Northern Europe, due to meltwaters from Greenland deflecting the Gulf Stream. What do you think of Hansen's most recent paper and the chances that a short-term cold weather event could happen?
it's useful to step back a little bit and ask about the amount of internal variability in the climate system and how that compares with the amount of warming that we're seeing on a year-by-year basis. We know that there is lots of variability, and that variability can amount to a tenth of a degree here and a tenth of a degree there. It's sufficient to mean that over any period of a few years, we might not see any warming, we might see cooling, but if you look over the string of decades, it's clear that we're seeing profound warming. Whether or not we might see cooling in some parts of the Earth system as a consequence of changes in the pattern of the winds or in the distribution of sea ice is an active area of research. And it highlights a general pattern, which is that in a rapidly changing climate, we should expect surprises. And even though we understand a vast amount of the fundamental physics of the way greenhouse gases are changing the climate, we don't understand all the details.
Do you think that goal of 1.5 degrees C warming is still possible?
When we talk about aggressive actions to tackle climate change, it's important to remember that there are profound risks from a changing climate, but there are also important risks from changing the energy system so rapidly that the prospects for hundreds of millions of people in the developing world are really put in jeopardy. Energy access is a key component of sustainable development. And we want to make sure when we think about a sustainable future that we're investing not only in protecting the climate, but also in protecting the access to development for the world's poor. So the question of, is it possible to limit warming to 1.5? The answer is clearly yes. We could shut off the global energy system tomorrow, and we would limit warming to less than 1.5. But that wouldn't be an attractive option. That would foreclose on legitimate aspirations of people around the world. What we need to do is figure out how rapidly we can decrease emissions, transition to a sustainable energy system that continues to provide energy access, at the same time it's not causing climate change. Doing that in a way that limits warming to 1.5 or less is absolutely at the limit of what could be accomplished. It might not be possible, but it's worth a serious effort.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Dr. Chris Field. He's a leading American scientist at Stanford University and in projects by the United Nations IPCC. Chris, is it true that all the intergovernmental panel pathways at or below 2 degrees of warming assume humans will employ carbon capture and storage, a technology that hasn't worked yet on any meaningful scale?
It's very difficult to figure out what set of technologies and in what relative proportions will address the climate problem. The analysis to date says that it's likely to be the lowest cost approach if we use a diversity of solutions, and that includes renewable energy from wind and solar, if we look at carbon capture and storage, and if we at least consider the possibility of using nuclear energy. Anytime you push options off the table, you tend to increase the risks in the remaining portfolio, you increase the likely costs. Carbon capture and storage is deployed very widely now. It's deployed mostly in enhanced oil and gas recovery, but we know that large quantities of CO2 can be injected into geologic formations and stay there. There's been a lot of discussion about a set of technologies that are often called negative emissions, and these involve growing biomass, using that to generate power and capturing the CO2 and injecting that. That involves combining two technologies that haven't been combined before, biomass energy and carbon capture and storage. The real issue with biomass energy with carbon capture and storage isn't so much whether or not the pieces of the technology work, it's whether there is sufficient growing land to produce the biomass in a way that doesn't impact biological diversity, doesn't impact food security, and doesn't impact livelihoods of the poor.
Right. I've been reading about that as blue carbon is one of those pathways.
The Earth system, the land and the oceans, remarkably productive and support amazing diversity of different life forms, including life forms in the ocean. And we know that many of these life forms are good at removing CO2 from the atmosphere and converting into biomass. And one of the things we're beginning to look more and more at is how we might modulate the various ecosystems so that we can store more carbon. Taking areas that used to have forests and restoring forests is a wonderful way to produce negative emissions. And there's been an increasing amount of focus recently asking whether there are parts of the ocean where we might do that as well, including coastal regions. And we know, for example, that most of the world's mangrove ecosystems have already been lost. If we could restore mangrove ecosystems, we could sequester a substantial amount of carbon, not enough to remove the pressure on addressing industrial emissions, but we could store significant amounts and make ecosystems a part of the solution.
Well, as you know, the Arctic is heating faster than anywhere on Earth, and that means ice melt, changes in ocean heating, methane from the seabed maybe, permafrost melt for sure, to name just a few worries. How seriously do you take threats from the Arctic?
We know that over the last many decades, the Earth system has provided a tremendous free subsidy to humans' emissions of heat-trapping gases. For every ton of CO2 that's released to the atmosphere, about half of it is taken up currently by the oceans and by ecosystems on land. That's an amazing free subsidy. We also know that in the warmer future, we may see some of the processes that have removed carbon from the atmosphere begin to release it. And the Arctic is one of the areas of greatest concern, partly because the Arctic is, as expected, warming much more rapidly than the rest of the planet, and also because very large quantities of carbon are stored, frozen in permafrost soils, especially in eastern Siberia. The carbon that's frozen in these soils has been described as frozen broccoli, in the sense that once it's thawed, it decomposes very rapidly. We don't have a good sense for how rapidly permafrost areas might thaw as a consequence of warming, but we know that with more warming, they're much more likely to thaw than with less warming.
All right, I'd like to read you a short paragraph from the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report released in 2014. It says, while the scope of the challenge is generally understood in the scientific and a growing policy and practitioner community, much of the public is still unaware of the enormity of the challenges involved in responding to and mitigating climate change, end quote. How could we tell them? What politician or media outlet, Chris Field, will systematically and persistently persuade the public we have to consume less and use far less energy?
If we look around the world, what we've seen in the last several years is really remarkable progress in confronting the magnitude and importance of the climate challenge. The 2014 agreement between the U.S. and China, incredibly important in breaking a logjam for countries to come together. And, of course, the Paris Agreement in December of 2015 is a real landmark in essentially all countries of the world agreeing that they need to come together aggressively to address the climate challenge. The issue now isn't so much countries recognizing that this is important. It's having countries make the kind of commitments to reduce emissions at the same time they're building sustainable energy systems. We're seeing meaningful progress around the world, but what we need to see is an increase in ambition so that that progress is accelerated.
You know, from emails, I can tell that some of my listeners are frustrated with the slow pace of science and government. The much-needed report on the danger of exceeding 1.5 degrees C that we'll be talking about with Catherine doesn't come out until 2018. An assessment of how governments are reaching, or more likely not reaching, their promises at Paris is set for 2023. That seems a ways away. Chris Field, is the process going slower than the climate is changing?
Yes, the process is going slower than the climate is changing, and there's a profound need for the world community, individual countries, individual citizens to realize that they can contribute more to solutions. I would say that the really dramatic change in understanding over the last year is partly a recognition that this is a problem we can solve, but it also was partly a recognition that there are real co-benefits, that aggressive investments in solving the climate challenge can also at the same time build robust economies and vibrant communities. Taking advantage of that creates huge opportunities for private companies, creates huge opportunities for subnational actors, for states and cities, and for individuals. Individuals can do a huge amount. They can do a lot through their consumption choices, through the way they vote, through the way they make investments. Companies can make a huge difference through the kinds of products they offer, through the kinds of policies they advocate for, and cities and states can make a huge difference.
You know, the IPCC doesn't have a world headquarters or a huge one with full-time scientists measuring climate and impacts in real time. That's what I'd like to see. Do you think we need a different institution, that people that are working on it all the time, full-time?
The world's fortunate to have tens of thousands of investigators really dedicated themselves to understanding the challenge of climate change and the opportunities for solutions. And that extends far beyond the academic community. It extends into governments and into private companies. There are lots and lots of mechanisms by which knowledge about climate change is assembled, and the IPCC is an important actor in that. The IPCC is uniquely qualified to provide definitive information about what we know and what we don't know in consultation with governments. But the IPCC is only one of many actors in this space, and it's important, especially in this era where we're driving towards solutions, that we recognize the importance of inputs from other kinds of actors, corporate actors, other sources of climate change assessments, from public pressure groups. And the IPCC plays a unique and critical role, but it's not fair to the world system, and it's not fair to the scientific community to ask the IPCC to do everything about creating solutions.
I see your point. So in all this, what is the role of the Carnegie Department of Global Ecology, where you work?
In my department, my own lab, we're dedicated to providing basic information about the way that climate change impacts ecosystems, about the way feedbacks from ecosystems, things like thawing permafrost, impact the climate system and alter the profile of risk, and about the kinds of solutions that individuals, companies, and governments can undertake, and the way those can contribute to solving what's really the defining challenge of our era.
Chris Field, are there other things you would like to add or talk about?
I think the really important thing for people to recognize now is that the climate challenge is at its core, one we can solve, and we can solve it in a way that creates a broad range of benefits beyond simply decreasing the amount of climate change that occurs. But we need to really tackle the challenge boldly, recognizing that standard ways of doing business, standard conversations about the role of individuals, companies, and countries really need to change. And if we tackle those challenges boldly and we see them as opportunities rather than as liabilities, tackling climate change can really be the entry point to a brighter future.
I have to say, though, wrapping it up, that I see hard and turbulent times ahead for my kids and grandkids because of this challenge of climate change. Would you disagree?
I would say that we're at a threshold. And if we ignore the challenge of climate over the next few decades, it's going to be really hard to come up with solutions that are compelling and rich with opportunity. Right now, we have a window of opportunity where it's not that the impacts of climate change can all be avoided, but they could be managed in a way that points us toward a better world. I'm concerned that the world will move too slowly to act at this moment of opportunity. But if it does, I really see addressing the climate challenge as an important step toward building a more sustainable, brighter future.
I hope you're right. From California, we've been speaking to a world climate science leader, Dr. Chris Field, from the Carnegie Institution Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University. Dr. Field is widely published in Science and has been an essential part of reports by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Chris Field, thank you for your years of dedication and for sharing with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Great to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
EcoShock.
From Stanford University in California, we're going to talk with one of the new generation of scientists already launched into the upper stratosphere of climate study and negotiations. Catherine Mack is a senior research associate at the Carnegie Sciences Department of Global Ecology at Stanford. Her CV says, and I'll quote it here, "For the past 5 years, Dr. Mack co-directed the scientific activities of Working Group 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which focuses on impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. This work culminated in the IPCC's fifth assessment report and its special report on managing the risks of extreme events and disasters to advance climate change adaptation, end quote. Well, that's huge. Catherine, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to talk with you.
We all hope scientists will be able to translate the big risks of climate disruption to world leaders. We hope there will be a plan that will save a climate worth living in. You've just been to an important meeting in Geneva. Who organized it and what was it about?
This particular meeting in Geneva really actually started with the Paris Agreement, which is the current latest international treaty guiding all of the action globally on climate change. The request in the Paris Agreement was for the IPCC, the definitive body for assessing what we know overall on climate change, to look specifically at a world of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. What are the impacts and risks at 1.5 degrees Celsius warming? And what does that mean for how we need to prepare for what's in the pipeline barreling towards us rather rapidly? And how do we integrate our adaptive responses with the full suite of action on the climate challenge?
So who was there?
This meeting in particular was what's called a scoping meeting. It was the very first meeting that happens in developing an IPCC report. Scientists come together with representatives of governments, and they consider what are the most important topics and questions around this issue, in this case, a world of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, what that means for how we adapt, and what it means in terms of how we ramp up our reactions and actions in the climate challenge right now.
And do we know, Catherine, how different our world would be if we had just 1.5 degrees C of warming versus 2 degrees C?
And maybe I'll even just start with the current world. You could say that the most important reason that people were coming together was this increasing recognition that climate change is not just a hypothetical, something out there far on the horizon, but instead something that's here and now with impacts that are already widespread and consequential on all continents of the world. Increasingly, we recognize that our current world, with its warming of about 1 degree Celsius, poses risks that for some people in some places are already dangerous, and those are risks that go up as we head towards 1.5, 2 degrees Celsius warming. There are a lot of different categories of risk where we can point to differences between our current world, a world of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, a world of 2 degrees Celsius warming. These are often around some of the most temperature-sensitive systems on the planet, coral reefs and fishing communities dependent on them, systems of Arctic sea ice and the indigenous peoples who make those systems part of their livelihoods and cultures. But there are also a lot of impacts that are very complex, that bear large consequences, the linkages between climate change and conflict. What happens when there's extreme events on one side of the planet and it ripples through in terms of impacts for supply chains around the globe? Those are some of the impacts where we know the risks go up from now to 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius warming, where we need to be prepared, but it's more challenging to point to precisely what the differences will be, and it really emphasizes the importance of thinking about risk.
I'm curious, do some of the scientists you talk with consider the possibility of abrupt climate change?
I think this question of abrupt climate change is really interesting, and it unfolds actually on a number of different timescales. When we say, in our current moment, what are the abrupt climate changes that matter? Oftentimes, it really comes down to extreme events. I think of extremes as the sharp end of the climate system, whether that's a heat wave, a flood, a drought, coastal storms, and what they mean in terms of both winds and flooding. Those sharp ends of the climate system's hazards, abrupt events happening now with unfolding risks around the world are where we see many of the most severe impacts for people, ecosystems, economies, and where we know climate change is driving up the risks into the future. This phrase abrupt also is very often used for things that are abrupt on geological timescales. And these are changes that may be irreversible and bear very large consequences that will play out over centuries to millennia. So when we say what's abrupt for an ice sheet, it actually may be some of the changes we're locking in terms of how these ice sheets will melt irreversibly over the next centuries to millennia due to our warming at present and the many meters of sea level rise that could entail.
All right, let's step back a minute. What is Working Group 2?
The IPCC is structured with three working groups overall. Working group two is the one where I devoted much of my efforts over the last several years, and it involves many hundreds of scientists from around the world looking in particular at what's at stake in a changing climate for people, economies, communities around the world, and what we can do to prepare for the impacts that are in the pipeline, baked into the system, at least on the climate side. This working group two sits in the entirety of the IPCC, which looks at everything from the physics of a changing climate, what's happening with hazards, sea level rise, feedbacks, all the way through to the full suite of climate change responses, which involve important needs and opportunities around reducing our emissions of heat-trapping gases.
So it's my understanding that the group you are working with for the scoping report on a new report is building on something called the Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction. Catherine Mack, please tell us what that is.
There are a variety of very fundamental, important foundations on the international landscape. Disaster risk reduction and the Sendai Framework is one of them. Another critical one has been the sustainable development goals put forward over the last few years, really looking at fundamental priorities for human development around the globe through the next decades. And I'd say that the third piece in this picture really was the Paris Agreement. All of these different dimensions of thinking about our actions right now, what those consequences are in terms of extremes, how we can prepare for them, and how we can really tap the fact that reducing disaster risks, adapting to climate change, is completely intertwined with the human endeavor more broadly, sustainable development, how we can build a better world on many different fronts simultaneously.
Yeah, you've raised something that I think the climate community has yet to grasp, which is the relationship between climate change and poverty. That's very important at the United Nations level, and yet when I look at the work of climate groups in North America and Europe, they're less concerned with it, obviously, because they aren't poor. So how do these two interlock?
I would say in many ways the challenge of climate change is all about poverty versus wealth and how we've achieved that historically and what that means for changing the vision moving forward. I think one of the most basic ways to think about this is that if we look at countries today in the world where people are wealthy, secure in their livelihoods, able to pursue their objectives and desires, those countries have reached that level of wealth through energy systems reliant on fossil fuels. So we have a very strong, nearly linear relationship between our emissions of heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere and the wealth of nations. And the challenge moving forward is to take that relationship and break it and to make sure we can find ways to achieve very high qualities of life, high levels of income per person in countries around the globe without that requiring fossil fuel emissions. We're not that far from a world where clean energy is the good stuff, where we don't need to rely on emissions of heat-trapping gases. And that can come on a variety of different fronts, all being deployed simultaneously. Some of that is how we tap renewable energy, wind and solar. Others might be how we move towards capturing emissions of heat-trapping gases and inject them underground. Other dimensions are being more efficient in our use of electricity and our the intensity with which that requires carbon emissions.
You know, getting back to that Sendai Agreement, I noticed that they call for fewer casualties from extreme climate, and that seems difficult when we consider about heat, drought, fires, storm surges, the unknown response of the insect world and diseases like Zika to climate disruption. How do experts and governments think saving lives is possible?
I think you're absolutely right that we have a clear understanding that our continued emissions of heat-trapping gases drive up the risks. And in many cases, the most complex risks are going to be very hard to predict in advance. These are outcomes that we may not have seen, whether that's to do with forest dieback or interactions of people losing their territorial integrity in small island nations. I think the very compelling component is that we see risks at present in the current world that do have a climate change signal that are also about natural variability. And we can use lessons from those to really understand what that means for preparing for risks moving forward. If you think about where is very sophisticated responses to uncertain futures happening in the current world, it's in realms like military or insurance. And there are sophisticated approaches that can be used for grappling with the fact that the future is always uncertain for a whole bunch of different reasons. Climate change adds uncertainty to that picture, but we can make very good guesses and evaluations and considerations of possible futures that embrace that uncertainty and figure out how we can meet our objectives nonetheless.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to the 2016 fall season opener of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's return to the workings of the official world as it grapples with unthinkable climate danger. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Catherine Mack, from the Carnegie Institution at Stanford University. We're talking about how science can advise governments on the dangers of extreme climate change. Catherine, I'm wondering, how does the United Nations work on adaptation fit in with a movement I'll call resilient communities in North America and in Europe?
You can really think about climate change adaptation, reducing vulnerability, increasing resilience, all being the same thing. They have slightly different shades and feels, and some words resonate with more some communities more than others, but they're getting at the same idea of how do we increase our toughness to the impacts that climate change bears? How do we safeguard our communities? How do we prepare for what's in store? I think what you might be pointing to in some ways emphasizes the degree to which this is not just international action. Becoming prepared for the impacts of climate change has dimensions that tie all the way down to the community level, what people are thinking about around the dining room table, in communities and churches together, what's happening at the scale of cities where many of the impacts of a changing climate hit the ground, especially in terms of extreme events, and how that adds up to national scale responses where governments will want to be able to deploy resources intelligently, decide where you deal with impacts in place, where you might want to move assets, how disaster relief should be shaped in a climate that is changing. The international framework, in many ways, provides an umbrella, a starting point for thinking about needs in different contexts, but all of those layers come together from communities to corporations, all the way through to the different levels of governance.
You know, every day from a science alert service, I get notices of at least a dozen new climate papers, and worldwide it's probably hundreds. How can massive streams of new data and scientific publications be assessed at the macro level? And I know that's something you specialize in. I suppose I'm asking, is the ecosphere beyond our ability to comprehend?
In a changing climate, in a world where there are multiple threats to sustainability and a whole suite of opportunities for thinking about shaping possible futures, grappling with the best available scientific foundations to inform our actions is essential. And I think you have exactly outlined the challenge of assessment, integrating our understanding across lines of evidence, recognizing that sometimes we'll have very quantitative projections, but we'll know that there are parameters in that model that are fundamentally unknowable, and we have to pair those quantitative evaluations of risk with more holistic understanding. So that is the challenge of assessment, and we see compelling examples of assessment happening in many different places around the world. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for example, is one prominent actor in the climate change assessment space. And it tackles that number of studies coming out very rapidly through a few fundamental dimensions. First, there's the mandate to be comprehensive. The hundreds of scientists that participate in the IPCC process are not just saying, you know, here's what my research says. Scientists participating as experts in the IPCC assessment process have a mandate for considering all of the available understanding towards any question being considered. So for the Working Group 2 report, that meant that there were close to 15,000 publications evaluated across the 2,000 pages of text. A major way that is achieved is through very extensive public reviews of the reports, where any expert in the world can sign up to submit comments on the assessment that's been achieved so far, and authors developing these reports then have to consider and respond to each and every one of those comments. It really pushes these reports to be representative as much as possible of the entire scientific endeavor in the current moment beyond just the hundreds of scientists who participate. I think a final part of the IPCC process that you see in many different climate change assessment contexts is the fact that there's a recognition that it's not just about scientists pushing science out into the world, but that that assessment is much more effective. It addresses questions that matter when there are two-way interactions between experts and decision makers shaping what questions do we need to know about right now to inform actions and decisions, and how can we make sure that decision makers see that full process of assessment and understand where the final results come from.
You know, personally, I think we need to add a third branch to the process. We have scientists, very expert scientists, advising governments, but somehow the corporations are on their own track. I mean, we presume, okay, governments are going to regulate corporations, but it would be great to see corporations more involved right at the first level of science.
I think that is absolutely right and fundamental. But in many ways, a frontier of climate change assessment right now is how do you make it relevant to the business community? How do you make sure that this is not just about national governments, but about every actor that is shaped by a changing climate? And how in so many cases, corporations encompassing the risks of climate change into their practice improves their profits really is about win-wins. As well as we look at many different places where the technological advancements and innovations that businesses entail in their work will be fundamental to solving the climate challenge and will really unfold the economic opportunities of this century. We've seen some innovations, for example, a risky business approach where there is a stakeholder model that was not just about government stakeholders, but about corporations and businesses and wide suites of decision makers. And I think very exciting opportunities lie ahead in terms of thinking about how to make sure the decision makers at the table are not just government decision makers, but everyone out there looking to make decisions in a changing climate.
Yeah, the risky business people brought in the whole idea of pensions, too, and how they invest and just sort of Wall Street investors. Anyway, the agenda for the upcoming report on extreme climate events calls for a study of impacts on food production. How is that going? What are you hearing?
Yes, so the IPCC has a suite of special reports coming out, and one of them will be focusing on land and food. And this will be quite a holistic look at how we think about sustainable agriculture in a changing climate, how we think about food security, recognizing that that may be about food production in some places and it really may be about access in others, and how we encompass land more broadly in our climate change mitigation responses as we think about enhancing sinks for greenhouse gases entering into the land, how we think about reducing sources, for example, through things like fires.
And these reports talk about adaptation. What kind of adaptation is possible?
Adaptation relevant across almost every part of the human endeavor. And, you know, part of the Paris Agreement has been how do we define our adaptation goals? And it's a profoundly deep question in that adaptation affects our use of water, for example. How do we think about making sure there's sufficient access to water resources globally in a changing climate? It jumps through to food. How do we think about both the production dimension as well as distribution in a changing climate and how climate change adds pressures to a system where there will be increases in food demand moving forward? How do we think about the diversity of responses as you go from cities through to rural areas and countrysides? How do we think about making sure our economies are resilient, both for the big developed countries of the world and for emerging economies where there are extra pressures from a changing climate? So I love adaptation because it touches really on every part of the human endeavor, from health to technology, from security to what we do within local communities. And that series of interactions, from defining goals at a very broad scale through to making sure each action we take can be evaluated and measured and monitored through time, is a very compelling domain in adaptation science where assessment will add value, but we're also going to be seeing a lot of action that we will need to learn from over the next few years.
Catherine, you were younger than some scientists I interview. You will probably live to see climate change hit every aspect of our lives and all living things. Personally, I think we're headed some very difficult decades, even if we try hard to change. Given what science knows, you personally, aside from what you might tell governments, what do you see in the future?
I think a very compelling part of my experience working on climate change in the assessment context is that I really have experienced the fact that this is a multi-generational issue. Many of the leading scientists right now at the peaks of their career have been watching the climate challenge unfold to date from the 80s and the 90s, where people were really trying to figure out, is this an issue that's unfolding right now? How big should the priority be in terms of how governments tackle it? And now we see those scientists increasingly having shifted through the IPCC framework to where I entered, a world where we understand that climate change is unambiguously happening. Warming is unequivocal. It's clearly due to humans. And we see some very stark choices moving forward. In terms of how things unfold into the future, it is something that will span the course of my life and the course of my children's life and grandchildren. And I think any scientist working on the issue right now would have that same perspective. I think we see the importance of our current moment, the fact that we need to be developing the technologies of this century, not just relying on those from the last century or the century before that, and that that's as much about economic opportunity as it is about challenges of innovation and potential for leadership. At the same time that we figure out the mitigation frontier, how we turn the tide on our rising emissions and drive them to zero, ideally within this century, we're also going to need to prepare for impacts baked into the climate system, what's in the pipeline already, and how that affects the ability of people around the world to meet their objectives. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a very compelling issue that will span decades into the future and touch on almost every part of what people are doing in countries throughout the world. And it's why it's an issue I love, and I think it's endlessly fascinating and important.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I've really enjoyed speaking with you today, and I think where we started, this 1.5 degrees Celsius report, in many ways, I think we'll put a current focus on what the impacts of climate change are right now, what that means for our actions in the next few years. And I think that will be an important unfolding as the years roll ahead and this Paris Agreement, which is really just a starting point for global action on climate change, unfolds and we see ambitious action increasing year after year.
From Stanford University in California, we've been talking with Catherine Mack. She is a senior research associate at Carnegie Sciences Department of Global Ecology. Catherine is also a driving force organizing science for the study of extreme climate events for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You can find links to many of the things we've been talking about, including some of those reports, in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Catherine, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It was great to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Can your baby hear and learn in the womb? Yes, that is true of many species. Can the unborn learn about climate change? Well, apparently so, as shown by a new scientific study in Australia. We'll go to the lead author, Mylène Mariette. She's the Alfred Deakin Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the Center for Integrative Ecology at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. Mylène, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what led you to this study and what kind of bird are we talking about?
So the bird we are talking about is actually a desert bird. So they live in the Australian arid zone, so they're adapted to being in hot places. And it's a small common bird, but it's also quite well known everywhere because it's also a cage bird, so people have them as pets. So that's a zebra finch. So I was studying it for my PhD and then for another project. And I was looking at the communication between the parents. So because both parents incubate the eggs and look after the chicks. And whenever they meet at the nest, they talk to each other. So I was recording those communication between the parents. And then that's when I noticed that sometimes when a parent is by itself in the nest with the egg, and his partner is away from the nest, sometimes that parent would make a completely different sort of call. And so I wonder whether they were talking to the eggs, and if so, what they could be telling them. So that's how it started.
So the desert finch, how do you know the mother birds are talking to their eggs about temperature?
So to do that, we did an experiment at the aviary, actually. So and in Melbourne, the weather changed a lot from one day to the next in summer. So it can be 43 degrees one day and 23 the next day. So that's not the most convenient, but yeah, really, Melbourne weather is famous for that, basically. So we did a lot of recordings every day in the nest of the parents when they were incubating. And then doing the analysis, it became really clear that the parents only produce that call when it's hot. So that's how we found out.
How do we know that embryos in the shell can hear the mother or father?
So we know there are different types of birds. So there are some birds that are quite developed when they hatch. So that's chicken and ducks. And so there the babies can leave the nest as soon as they hatch. And in those birds, there had been a lot of studies done. And we know that they hear and they even produce call before hatching. In birds that are less developed when they hatch, and so those ones stay in the nest for several weeks after they've hatched, and when they hatch, they are naked and blind. Those ones, we didn't really know they could hear before hatching, but our results show that they can. So that's one of the nice things about our study.
And Milene, what makes you think the baby in the shell learned anything about a changing climate?
So we don't really know whether they learned anything per se, but by hearing that call that normally is associated with heat, then they changed the way they adjusted their growth to the temperature that they experienced after hatching. So it's not so much that they learned about it, but it's just that hearing that call, they knew that it was going to be hot, and so they knew they had to adjust their growth. So that's what we found.
Yes, you found the embryos hearing the signal of hotter weather actually weighed less when born. Usually that's thought to be a disadvantage, is it?
Yeah, so we were a bit surprised, actually. Normally it's better when babies are a bit heavier when they leave the nest because they have more chance of escaping predators or just surviving without less food. So, yeah, normally it's better to be heavy. But in that case, we found that it was actually better to be light if it had been hot. And the way we did this, to find out whether it was a good thing, we kept the birds and then gave them a chance to breed when they were adults. And we found that the ones that were lighter in hot nests produced more babies as adults. So, but that's, we think, is specifically being light in hot condition. It's not just being light.
Well, that's something that I've noted from other biologists, especially when they study deep time, that species that were smaller can do better in a hotter world. And there's been some indication that maybe things will just get smaller in response to climate change.
Yeah, so it's definitely a general pattern that we've been seeing either through time, which we think is to do with climate change, or with latitude. So animals tend to be smaller in hotter climates. But even if we see that pattern across animals, and that's birds, mammals, reptiles, everything, we don't really know whether it's a good or a bad thing. So in our species, we found that it could be a good thing. But in other species, it is actually bad. So, and there was recently a paper on red knots. So they are shorebirds. And in that species, they've shown a clear decline in the baby's size with time. But babies being smaller also have a smaller bill. And it means that they are less able to reach the food in the mud when they grow up. So then they have a much lower survival in their wintering ground. So, we need to do a lot more study to know whether being smaller is actually a good thing in hotter places. It's a pattern we see a lot, but at the moment we don't know whether it's good or bad. So for Harvard specifically, we think that maybe reducing growth in hot condition allows them to avoid the cost of growing in the heat because it's just a costly process, basically. So growing is normally quite hard on the body, obviously, because it makes the cell work really hard. And doing so in the heat is harder because there is a risk of overheating, basically. So, yeah, so far we don't really know what the mechanism is for smaller body being an advantage. We have several possibilities, but, yeah, that's still something we need to work on.
And I think part of the appeal of this new science, Milene, is that we all share a worry about our babies in the womb. I've talked to women who wonder if extra heat or worries about global warming even will affect their unborn children. From your work, at least we can say in one species, these subliminal messages may not be all harmful. They may have a benefit. You found some benefit.
Yeah, no, and I think in general, because the communication before birth exists, it's likely to be beneficial. So, and what we found that the parents can actually provide information about the environment to their babies in before birth. Yeah, that is a good thing, and it is quite encouraging because it means that birds have more flexible strategy than we realized, because we didn't know they could do that. We know they have other ways of influencing the development of their babies, so they can change the size of the egg or the content in hormones or those sort of things. But now we know that they can even call to them, and then that changes their development. So that's quite encouraging.
Does your study apply to all birds?
No. So, I mean, we'll need to do more study to find out. So I think it means that it's quite likely that other bird species also talk to their eggs, but the connection with heat may be more specific to species who breed in hot environments. And also, because the zebra finch is a desert species, they can breed any time of the year, so because they breed usually after rain, so they can be breeding in winter or in summer. So in those specific conditions, it makes sense to have a strategy to tell the embryos whether or not it's going to be hot. In species that breed like in spring or at a very specific time of the year all the time, then maybe they wouldn't have evolved a strategy to warn their babies about the heat, but maybe they're, telling them about something else in the environment.
What will you study next?
So next we really want to understand what happened. So, we want to understand the physiological mechanism behind the effects that we found on the growth. So, and that would be really quite exciting to look at how sound before birth can affect the physiology of the embryos and the babies. So that's the next step.
From Deakin's University in Melbourne, Australia, we've been talking with Milene Mariette, with Catherine Buchanan. Milene is the lead author of the paper, Prenatal Acoustic Communication Programs Offspring for High Post-Hatching Temperatures in a Songbird, and that was published August 19th, 2016, in the journal Science. You can find links to that paper in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Milene, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
That's all the time we have for this week. In our next program, I'll be covering the extreme events around the globe and the various canaries that have already passed out down in that coal mine. I'll be talking with a science correspondent. You can tune in to the worries you may have missed this summer as the media snoozed on. I'm Alex Smith. Get more of my show blog at ecoshock.info. It's published every Wednesday. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.